I think initially we were asked to keep a little quiet about it because the White House was putting out its own press release. But enough time has passed that I'm very happy to share, because it was a huge honor for me personally and a unique experience. So basically, making a long story short, I get an email out of the blue saying, are you available on Tuesday to meet with President Biden in a small group in San Francisco? And my reaction was like, of course, it's an honor. And I was very happy with San Francisco not having to fly all the way to D.C. in the heat. So I flew there, and I'll actually talk to you about one idea that came out of it, is actually brought up by Tristan Harris, of fame of The Social Network, and he runs the Center for Humane Technology. He raised the issue of extreme misinformation, particularly that around the election cycle. So imagine if 24, 48 hours before the election, suddenly there's all this information showing that one of the candidates had a major coronary event. And you have pictures of it, you have video, you have newspaper articles, you have experts talking about what the likely medical outcome is. You have people being targeted to retweet this. A flood like that is very hard to identify and stop before it makes an impact on the election. Our elections have been so close, it could really tip the election one way or another.
Hi, I'm Boaz, founder and CEO of Simply Augmented, and I'm excited that you are tuning into Shift, a show that explores what it takes to thrive and adapt to the changing workplace in the digital age of remote work and AI. In today's episode, I'm thrilled to have Oren Etzioni as our guest. Oren is technical director of the AI2 Incubator and was the founding CEO of the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence. During our conversation with Oren, we explore his background and experience building AI companies, advising students at the University of Washington, and meeting with President Biden to discuss the issues and implications of AI in our society. If you're someone interested in how AI is going to factor into your everyday work and life, you won't want to miss this episode. It's great to have Oren on our podcast, and we can't wait to learn more from him. Let's get to it. Hello, Oren. Welcome to the Shift podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Buzz, it's my pleasure.
I am really, really excited to talk to you today. It's been a long time since we've chatted, and there's been so much going on in the AI space, and there's a lot to catch up on. But before we start, this is a Shift podcast is about the future of work. And I always like to start the show reading to you your work history. I'm going to read it back to you. And if I get anything wrong, you can let me know. Okay.
Sure. Ready?
This is an interesting one too. So, co-founder of NetBot, April 1996, acquired by Excite. Next, co-founder of ClearForest, acquired by Thomson Reuters. Then CTO of GoToNet. Founder at Faircast, acquired by Microsoft. A lot of acquisitions in those early years. And then the co-founder and CTO of Decide, which was acquired by eBay. From there, you went to be the CEO of AI2. And I'm sure during that time, I'm not sure the exact time frame, but you were a professor at the University of Washington, of course, thinking a lot about AI. You're also a venture partner at Madrona Venture Group. And now, which we'll talk about today, a technical director at the AI2 Incubator. And I know you're thinking a lot about the startup ecosystem. So it's a long, interesting career. Did I get everything right?
Yes. The only thing I would say is for most of my career, starting in 1991, being a professor at the University of Washington was my main job. Some of the companies were what we nowadays call a side hustle. And my goal was often to hand them over to adult management, who deserves a lot of credit. You know, Mike Fridgen, who was the CEO of The Side, Hugh Crean, who was the CEO of Faircast. And so I would found them or co-found them, then hand them over to adult management. Really, another TLDR view of it, I was a professor, and then I helped the late Paul Allen launch the Allen Institute of AI, where I was the CEO for 9 years from inception until last fall. So when you talk about the future of work, for me, the future is right now. I am experiencing the future of work. I'm talking to you from home. I'm doing a bunch of different things, and yes. So long answer to your question, but I wanted to give credit where credit is due.
No, that totally makes sense. And as a professor, just so the audience understands, I mean, most of your career was spent thinking about compute and computing, but what issues in particular to computer science?
Well, my focus has always been on AI, and I also worked on what's called data mining, sometimes called big data, worked on web search and things like that. And actually, just as an example, in 1994, my colleague Dan Weld and I wrote a paper that appeared in the Communications of the ACM about software agents, something that in the intervening period hasn't really come to fruition, but now with large language models and so on, we are seeing in the workplace. And of course, companies like UiPath and others have taken shots at that. But I feel like we are going to revisit that work over the coming decade.
It's amazing that, you know, what we're going through right now, given your background. And I don't want to embarrass you, but I know a lot of people in the Seattle area think about you as kind of one of the top voices in AI. And so for you, it must just be incredible to see all of this unfold in the last, you know, 8 to 9 months.
I have to admit that it is a lot of fun. It is super dynamic. I sometimes joke with my wife that the last year has been some of the most full and dynamic 10 years. In my career. Just so much is happening, and it's happening so fast. I, though, despite having worked in AI for decades, like many of us, am very much trying to figure it out. So it's not like I'm sitting there going, I told you so, I told you so. Hey, it's much more like, wow, did we do this?
Yeah.
And of course, in fairness, OpenAI and others are really the at the cutting edge, but now we're all part of it, whether we're consumers, whether we're in the workplace, or whether we're AI researchers or innovators, right? We're in the middle, or actually not in the middle, in the beginning, I would say, of a major tectonic shift. And that is something that's moving all of us in somewhat different ways.
It's really exciting. We're all learning. I was at the AI Tinkerers last night, and watching, you know, it's kind of, for those that don't know about the AI Tinkerers, it's kind of like homebrew meets AI, and a lot of really smart technologists doing demos. And it's just so exciting. The energy is amazing. Well, before we get into the deep AI stuff, there's a couple of questions I like to ask everybody that's on the show, just to kind of establish kind of the personal nature. So what was your first job? The first job where you got paid, actually got paid?
My first job, and still one of my very favorites, was when I was in high school. I had a part-time job as an ice cream scooper at Baskin and Robbins. And I was paid minimum wage, but I had the fringe benefit explicitly told, hey, you can have as much ice cream as you can eat. And, you know, I was 16 years old, right? You don't gain weight. And so I ate a lot of ice cream per shift. And, you know, made very creative milkshakes with all kinds of fun ingredients. And that was a phenomenal job. And it was nice. What, they're paying me for this? And then at the end of the week, you know, I even got a paycheck. So that was still my first and one of my most favorite jobs.
That's great. Well, you answered my first two questions, first and favorite. How about your parents? What kind of jobs did your parents have? And was work and the idea of business and work talked about at the dinner table, was it part of the family conversation?
So both my parents were professors, and they very much encouraged me, each in their own way, to go into the quote-unquote family business, which is being an academic. So it was very natural for me to choose a topic, delve into it, get a PhD, and become a professor. It was only later that I found my way to entrepreneurship and business, and I'm super glad I did. But really, the first chapter of my life was super academic.
And so that must have been a topic of conversation. I mean, the kind of notion of academia and big topics and those kind of conversations must have been happening all the time.
Well, it's interesting because one of my favorite definitions of a university, where professors are ultimately, you know, applying for grants, funding their labs, funding students, things like that, is that it's a bunch of small entrepreneurs joined together by a common grievance about parking. So it's very kind of, you know, you eat what you kill sort of thing. But at the dinner table, we didn't talk about that. We didn't talk about grant writing. We didn't talk about entrepreneurship. Really, both my parents are very intellectual. So we were often having conversations about issues of the day. What's wrong with economics? How do political elites, they're both interested in political science, in sociology, in policy. So we talked about a wide range of things, but actually business and even engineering topics were largely absent. Both my parents were humanists. And as a computer scientist, I did run pretty far away from that, at least initially.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Well, let's talk about some of the stuff that's happening today and the things that you're doing now. So let's talk about that. How does that relate to AI, the future of work, things that you're presently doing?
So at the AI2 Incubator, where I'm a technical director, and also at Madrona Venture Group, where I'm a venture partner, I see a ton of work that isn't just kind of loosely, right? We're ruminating about the future of work, but it's much more, we're building something that's going to make work a lot better for you. So let me give two quick examples of Seattle area startups. One is Read AI, which is backed by Madrona and led by a former colleague of mine from Faircast, David Shim, super talented guy who went from Faircast to Quantcast and from there to a startup called Placed that was acquired by Foursquare. He has an illustrious history. But he posed the question that we're in one of these meetings, and these days they're typically or very often video meetings. How do you read the room most effectively, right? And his answer was, well, we're going to build a tool that's going to join the meeting alongside you, track engagement, track people's mood, their reaction to what you're saying, even when there's, let's say, 50 people in the room and it's very hard for you to do, or even, you know, 20 people on a call. And furthermore, come up with an automated summary of the meeting. What were the action items? What were the key questions discussed? Who said what? And of course, that work has received a huge boost with the new large language models. So great example. We're going to make meetings more effective using this kind of tool. Another of my favorite examples, this one is at the AI2 Incubator, is a company called Yoodlee, Yoodlee.ai. Maybe you're familiar with it. And that's...
I am. Yeah, super interesting.
It's in some sense the complement to Read AI. So Read AI is about read the room. Sometimes I think of Yoodlee as write AI, meaning how do we express ourselves most effectively, whether it's in a meeting or an interview or public speaking, which of course is a big fear for a lot of people. And they have a whole set of things to help you be more effective in your communication. So that's the right part, right? So, you know, I have this vision that one day there'll be write AI and read AI, and they'll combine to just this AI assistant that sits, you know, looks over your shoulder and just helps you read the room, say the right things, maybe remember key talking points or key details. It might be in your glasses, so that you have augmented reality and it reminds you, oh, you know, I really should ask Boaz about his kids, whatever, all that good stuff.
You know, when you think about the point solutions that are out there, and Read AI is a great example because I'm seeing that a lot. I'm seeing that in meetings that I'm in, and I'm reading about it a lot too. There's a bunch of use cases that seem like it's low-hanging fruit for this technology, but every day, because of how easy it is now to have a layer that calls an API, so many companies are coming out so fast. How do you think about the ecosystem that's happening right now with all of these startups, point solutions versus incumbents, and the way that that's all going to kind of shake out?
That's a fantastic question, and I don't know that I can do it justice in the time we have. So let me pick some pieces of it and happy to delve more into what you said.
Sure.
First of all, it is true that the incumbents have something of an advantage, right? It requires a lot of work to build and train these models. But at the same time, that's rapidly changing with models like Llama 2 from your former employer that's been open sourced. The Allen Institute for AI is releasing its own open source model soon, very high quality. And so are many folks, right? So there's a very interesting interplay between the models created by the major incumbents, the cloud providers and so on. And on the other hand, these open source models that are very widely available. So I think that balance of power is actually TBD. The second thing that's happened, as you alluded to, there's been a tremendous number of companies that have the form of, I call it putting lipstick on an API, right? Taking one of these very powerful APIs and just building a small interface around it that can be quite fun and quite suggestive. I would say typically these simple point solutions are not enough to, so neither Udly or ReadAI or many of the other companies that are emerging with strong offerings, they don't just do that. They often have multiple different calls to the API. They deal with permission issues, with keeping state across sessions, with personalization to the user, et cetera, et cetera. So sometimes people say, okay, what we're going to see in the future is the incumbents, right, providing these broad services, these language models through their API, and a whole bunch of little thousand points of light doing little things with that. And I don't think so. What I see is a lot of opportunities to build more sophisticated tools for the workplace and for the home that utilize generative AI, but do it in more powerful ways than lipstick on an API.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I've read recently some of the things you've written about some of the limitations around open source and closed and LLMs in general. Can you tell the audience just a little bit about that? Because there's this idea that AI is going to fix everything. But right now, there's some limitations around this technology. Can you go into that a little
bit? Sure. So let me mention, first of all, a mundane limitation, which is just latency and cost, right? So if you're trying to use these models through the API in a real-time context, it can take a while, which is frustrating if you're used to doing something interactively like search or what have you. And if you're doing it at large scale, the costs start to add up. So those are mundane things. But a more profound thing, which you're probably alluding to, is the fact that you can't by any means 100% rely on what comes back from these models. They can be toxic, or if they have guardrails on them, they can just be refuse to answer a lot of your questions or to engage with you. But probably the biggest worry, and it's really important for everyone to remember, is that they hallucinate. They will invent things in response to your questions. And the funny thing is if you question them further, they tend to double down, kind of like a unreasonable person, and they'll continue to believe and justify in funny ways what you invented. And you have to remember that for these models, what they're computing is kind of what's the next word to say? What's the next phrase? How do I complete the sentence on this paragraph? They don't think about things like what's factual, what's really accurate. And so you do have to be very careful to verify and corroborate information generated by a large language model.
Yeah, that's super helpful. You know, there is there was a few hype cycles that came before this one. It feels like we're in an AI hype cycle right now, but I feel like this one's a little bit different, that the tail is a little bit longer, that the use case is much broader across lots and lots of different verticals. And so, you know, you've been through a lot of hype cycles too from a technology standpoint over the years. So can you talk about this one? Does it feel different to you too?
So first of all, I would say that there's two kinds of hype cycles, right? And one, say, around the internet, where sure, we had accesses, I don't know, pets.com, or for all I know, you know, bricks.com, where we're going to ship you a brick for a, you know, an affordable price. I mean, that's a you know, a made up example, but it could just as well be that, right? So, but of course, from that emerged a tremendous change to how we do things. And from some of the e-commerce follies and for some of the losses that occurred early on, I remember where people referring to Amazon.com as Amazon.com or as a nonprofit, right? Because it was generating such huge losses. You know what? Nobody's calling them Amazon.com anymore. It's just an absolute juggernaut. So I think there's sometimes there's a little bit of early overenthusiasm, but there's a fundamental premise, whether it's the internet or e-commerce, that, you know, completely changes the world. The second one is, you know, whether it's the Dutch tulip frenzy back in the day or a lot of what I've seen under crypto, which I'm quite a skeptic about. There's some hype cycles that don't eventuate in much. And certainly AI had some of those back in the 70s of 80s of the previous century. There was a huge AI hype cycle that led to the AI winter because the technology did not fundamentally work. The technology that we have today fundamentally works, and you don't have to take my word for it, right? Literally hundreds of millions of people, if not billions, have already tried it and are already using it in various ways. In fact, a lot of them at the forefront are young people, students, using it to do their homework, to help with their homework. So I think we have a very strong basis for seeing that there's useful technology in our hands, and the technology continues to evolve, right? So we started with language models, then we added pictures, now it's generating code. A lot of the software engineers are using it, again, not to replace them, but to help them with mundane tasks. Things have been released that can do data analysis, you know, OpenAI code interpreter. It just goes on and on. So I would be happy to take a bet, a 10-to-1 bet, you know, anybody who says that this is a pure hype cycle. There's, you know, a lot of there.
Yeah. I want to give you a chance to talk about the incubator that you're working on right now. Will you tell me a little bit about that and, you know, some of the things that you're doing in the incubator, how you're hearing about enterprises embracing some of the tech that you guys are trying to bring to market. Tell the audience a little bit about the incubator.
Sure. Let me take a step back to answer that question and then quickly home back in on the incubator. I appreciate it. It's one of my favorite topics. So taking a step back, Jacob Kolker, who's managing director at the incubator and my colleague there, and I wrote an article in GeekWire a few years ago. Now it seems like forever, but it was just 3 or 4 years ago, arguing that Seattle is about to experience a boom in startups. And this is part of actually based on what I've seen in Madrona over many years, as Madrona has made great investments, has expanded, as I've seen engineering centers like from Facebook and, you know, easily over 100 other Bay Area companies, Google, so many others. Come into Seattle. Yeah. University of Washington, kind of like this Stanford was in Silicon Valley. We have University of Washington, Seattle. A lot of components come together to produce this. And in fact, that's what happened. The amount of venture capital that's in Seattle has grown tremendously. The amount of startup activity has grown. And of course, there are these iconic companies that are older, but incredibly important. Microsoft, Amazon, Starbucks, Costco, many others. And they're, of course, a source of inspiration, capital, right, from people who left there and talent and so on. So now, when we looked at that, we felt like there were two things that, despite this growth, were really missing. And the first one was singular focus on AI. Now it seems like, of course, you're going to focus on AI. When the incubator started, which was actually in 2014, that was a lot less clear. And the second thing is the focus on pre-seed. So we have plenty of companies, including ones who come in from the Bay, right, who will fund the Expedias and Zillows of the world or the Smartsheet, you know, before their IPO. But what about if you're a couple of folks with a really powerful idea and you need help to get started? So over the last few years, emerged several incubators, PSL, Pioneer Square Labs, MVL, Moderna Venture Labs, and us. We're the most technical and AI focused of the three, where we really work with very talented small teams, one or two people to start. And we have a program that helps them get and raise their seed financing. And it's been incredibly popular, particularly with the current interest of AI. We can barely keep up with the demand. We've been able to raise capital. We raised a $10 million fund and followed shortly afterwards by a $30 million fund. And folks like Madrona and Sequoia, right, the famed Sequoia from Silicon Valley, invested in Google and many other huge companies, is in there too. Sigma out of New York. So we have been building a network, also affiliated with the AI2 nonprofit research, that has really been producing some very, very exciting companies. And just to give you a sense of it, the total scale, if you add up the financings of all the companies that we've produced, including an exit, a company named Exnor that was sold to Apple for a reported, you know, $200 million or so, the total is rapidly approaching $1 billion. So the total value created. So we're very, very proud of that. Yeah. And the best is yet to come.
That's amazing. So there's a lot of founders that listen to this show. And what is the best way for them to get in touch with you if they're excited and have a great ideas and want to pitch and want to get involved?
If you go to AI2Incubator.com, we have an application form. We do need you to fill that out simply because there's a lot of, you know, very large volume of applications, but somebody looks at every single one very carefully. And I do have to confess, it's a small shop. So because we put so much effort into helping these startups, the number that we do per year is still relatively small. It's not Y Combinator or Techstars. On the other hand, if you make it in, you know, I'll make the personal guarantee that I will personally help you as a founder as much as I possibly can, because we get really involved, not just as a co-founder, a small co-founder of these companies, but emotionally and intellectually. We really want to help these founders succeed. And I feel both a responsibility and a joy, right, having started a few companies myself, of just being as helpful as I can to early stage founders.
I love it. I love it. All right, founders, you heard it here on Shift. Oren's gonna take special interest when you get accepted to the AI2 Incubator. All right. So Oren, I've been waiting for you to get on, and so excited because one of the things I wanted to ask you about was this. When we were texting a few weeks ago, you had told me, you know, I'd really want to do the show, but I'm on my way to Washington, D.C., and I'm going to go talk to Biden, and we're going to be talking about AI. And then I saw you, you know, I saw a clip of you with a bunch of others, you know, talking to him, and I'm just dying to know how that went and what you guys talked about. So whatever you can share would be amazing.
Sure. Well, thanks for the question. I think initially we were asked to keep a little quiet about it because the White House was putting out its own press release, but enough time has passed that I'm very happy to share, because it was a huge honor for me personally and a unique experience. So basically, making a long story short, I get an email out of the blue saying, are you available on Tuesday you know, to meet with President Biden in a small group in San Francisco? And my reaction was like, of course, it's an honor. And I was very happy with San Francisco not having to fly all the way to D.C. in the heat. So I flew there. And again, there's funny stories about how they really turned the place where I was into a fortress and make the security very, very tight. But the most interesting thing is 10 of us or so were ushered into a room, and the president came in. He was engaged. He was witty. You know, he's not a technical superstar, but he was asking really good questions. And each of us had a chance to talk to him about various ideas. And because time is limited, I'll actually talk to you about one idea that came out of it is actually brought up by Tristan Harris, fame of The Social Network, and he runs the Center for Humane Technology in the Bay Area, and I'm actually hoping to collaborate with him on this project. He raised the issue of extreme misinformation, particularly that around the election cycle. So imagine if 24, 48 hours before the election, suddenly there's all this information showing that one of the candidates had a major coronary event, one of the two candidates. And you have pictures of it, you have video, you have newspaper articles, you have experts talking about what the likely medical outcome is. You have people being targeted to retweet this or re-exit, I don't know what one says these days, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A flood like that is very hard to identify and stop before it makes an impact on the election. Our elections have been so close, it could really tip the election one way or another.
Yeah.
So what I call extreme or severe misinformation is a huge problem as we get close to the elections, can be a huge problem for our economy when somebody posted a picture of a fake picture of the Pentagon being bombed. That resulted in a glitch in the market.
Yeah.
So you can imagine that much more sophisticated attacks could cause a run on the banks or something like that. And so I'm very interested in figuring out how to leverage some of the research that's been done, some of the tools to build a coherent response, both to detect and respond to these events. And I have to mention another Madrona company, Pendulum, which looks at that problem very seriously, at harmful narratives, particularly on YouTube. That's one example. There's the Center for the Informed Public at the University of Washington, run by Kate Starbird and Gavin West. There's a lot of building blocks there, but it's not the case that today we have a solution that says, okay, we have a dashboard that's publicly available that's going to warn us if something like this is happening. And I think that we need one.
Yeah, the policy issues are really interesting. I think the ethical issues are interesting too. I've been reading a lot about AI and the future of work and what happens when a lot of our work tasks and the mundane tasks that we do are taken over by computers. We're going to be allowed to be more creative, more strategic, but there might be less work. And I thought it was interesting to think about the way that work provides us meaning in our lives, different jobs, and the way that we're going to have to moderate and mediate this with machines in the future. Have you been thinking a little bit about the ethical issues related to AI?
Yes, there are numerous ethical issues, whether it's privacy, whether it's the impact on democracy, whether it's the impact on surveillance, right? We see countries like China using technology that we thought would enhance democracy to actually further their totalitarian hold on power. So a lot of appropriate concerns. But to specifically address yours, I do see displacement coming. I see less work in some ways. I see specific tasks and down the road roles, particularly more mundane roles, being displaced and so on. And of course, we have a history of this, right? Sometimes people forget that 98 to 99% of the people in this country used to work in agriculture, right? And now it's something like 1%,
right? That's right.
And that example is kind of an optimistic one in the sense that the effect of that over time has been that we have more food, that the food is cheaper, and that people are not engaged in this backbreaking work. And of course, they've found other jobs. That said, that narrative that I just sketched, which technologists love, is a little bit over-optimistic because it overlooks the displacement and suffering that occurred over time while we were having that transition. So I do think that there's a major issue around jobs. I think it could potentially happen a lot faster than people hope. And I think it's the kind of thing where we do want to see the government intervene appropriately with training programs, with making sure that people are treated appropriately if they're out of a job. All that said, I am still very much an optimist. I think that AI and specifically generative AI can be a huge empowering tool, a huge enabler for increased productivity. Increased productivity is ultimately good for everyone, right? It's driven a lot of successful economic growth. And if done right, it could leave folks with a choice, right? Say, well, you know, maybe I'm going to work less hard. When's the last time that people had the opportunity to work less hard? We seem to be working harder and harder. And of course, our population is shrinking. So there's definitely challenges down the road if we don't increase productivity. And AI is very much about increased productivity. We just need to make sure that the weakest members of society are treated right as productivity is increased and wealth is created.
I'm sure you dug into this when you were meeting with the president, but what policy issues, I know we probably can't go into all of them, but can you choose one policy issue that came up that you feel strongly about or that the president felt strongly about related to AI?
Well, I think one of the topics, which is a terrific one, is the issue of where does American society invest its resources for moonshot projects? So look, there's a lot of thorny issues. Mm-hmm. I brought up immigration, which I'm very passionate about. You know, we really should be treating our immigrants, or whether they're undocumented or whether they're students who come here to get a degree and want to stay. So many people who come here for an H-1B and are then laid off by a major corporation, we should be treating them a lot better because ultimately they're so beneficial to our society. But that's a very thorny and complex issue. There's disagreement among the parties and et cetera, et cetera. But something that generally we as Americans love is moonshot projects, right? Like the way, you know, we defeated the Russians, right? And the Sputnik project in getting to the moon.
Yeah.
And the president is very passionate about moonshot projects to address cancer, which is incredibly important. And of course, AI has a tremendous role to play in biology. The kind of models that we've seen, generative models, I think will completely revolutionize biology. And of course, CRISPR, and actually one of the inventors of CRISPR, a Nobel laureate, was there as well to kind of provide some of that inspiration. So I think that one of the things that the president would love to see is proposals brought to him for new moonshot projects that are going to transform society, American society and the world in really positive ways. And one that he's already invested in is cancer. And I think we can afford more than one inspiring moonshot project.
Yeah, that's super, super interesting. You know, with all this talk about AI agents and AI assistants, I like to ask this question about mentors that you've had in your life that have been super impactful to your career.
Wow. That's a wonderful question because it leads me immediately folks come to mind. Let me mention two who are local to Seattle. One is the late Tom Ahlberg, who's the lead founder of the Madrona Venture Group, and was a tremendously visionary individual. He was first person to invest in Amazon back when it was kind of a, seemed like a completely crazy idea. And he was also a huge investor in Seattle and its future. He really foresaw decades ago what Seattle is becoming now. And of course, it's a work in progress. So the thing that Tom Ahlberg emphasized, because he was also a very savvy and successful investor, is what I call a kinder and gentler venture capital. So when I met him in, more than 20 years ago, he was talking about how, you know, we like to leave some money on the table. We're not like not to like strike the best most hard-nosed deal possible because we hope to work with these again. And Madrona is often, you know, if you look at Aptio, multi-billion-dollar company. The founder, Sunny Gupta, worked with Madrona multiple times. First at Performant, which is a UW spinout. I was on the board of, and later in a number of companies before I got there. And he came back because of, yeah. of this kinder gentle. So I feel like I was really inspired by Tom to remember to think long-term about relationships. You know, a second inspiration for me is Ed Lazauska, which he knows so many people in our world. I wouldn't be surprised if, I don't know, half your listeners either know him personally or know of him. He's, to those of you, to the other half, he's the former chair of the Computer Science Department at the University of Washington. He's dedicated his entire career to building up that department. It's now the Allen School, and it's got thousands of undergrads and hundreds of grad students and just many, many important inventions and wonderful things. And Ed is one of the most selfless people I know in how he helps to promote junior faculty. He serves on the board of the Allen Institute of AI, which is a completely uncompensated position. And I see him so much helping, doing things for the good. And again, just a huge inspiration to me as I'm now a little bit older to do the same, to help help Seattle, help the university, help founders just be their best selves.
I'm glad that you brought up the university because I think you have an interesting perspective. You get to hear startups pitch you, but you also get to see students in the work that they do at the university, and you're still very involved in the university. When you think about the next 5 years, and ten years, what do you think are the emerging technologies that you're the most excited about? AI included, but it could be others too.
Well, we've talked about AI, which is my main focus. But and by the way, AI is a huge enabler. So some of the things I mentioned, like I mentioned, I think we're going to see major revolutions in biology, major revolutions in medicine, and they're fueled by AI models, but also by advances in biology itself. I see in material science tremendous things, right? So we've now, we've sequenced the genome. Recently, we've sequenced the 3D structure of proteins. That's something that I don't think we've understood just how powerful that is. And at UW, there's the Institute for Protein Design, led by David Baker, that's both doing world-class science, but also is leading to a variety of spin-out activities. So I think there's just tremendous things going on there. Quantum is something that we're all intrigued about, but I don't know that much about. Of course, there's the recent discussions of superconductivity, and again, I don't know. I think likely the recent news is not quite what we were hoping. But more generally speaking, I think the future of energy research, whether it's carbon sequestration, right, putting carbon into materials and taking it out of the atmosphere, or whether it's more efficient energy production or transmission, is again a huge, huge dimension, a very necessary one. As we're dealing with climate change and so on. So you're so right. I feel very privileged to be at the university and really have my finger on the pulse and be able to see these young, dynamic, energetic people be curiosity-driven, creative, and even crazy in the absolutely the best sense of that word, right? Just that's what you need to do at a university to come up with the inventions that down the road with companies like Google and Microsoft and so many others make our lives better.
It's inspiring. And it really does make me think a lot about Seattle and the way that Seattle has come to the fore in regards to new technology, emerging technology, cloud services. It's really, really exciting. Well, I've got one last question for you. I like to end the show with this question, which is, describe in two words the future of work. You can elaborate, but try to nail down the future of work in two words.
AI tools. So again, despite the worries about job displacement and things and the legitimate concerns, I fundamentally see us using calculators, spreadsheets, word processors to be more effective at our jobs. the next generation of tools, whether it's in the spreadsheet or in the word processor, whatever, you're going to help us write faster, are going to help us create presentations faster, are going to help us communicate more effectively, are going to help us remember what happened in a meeting and what the actions items are better, going to help us in so many ways. So what I see is a new generation of tools in the workplace that are going to make those who use those tools be positioned for both greater productivity and maybe even greater rest. If I can do my 60-hour week job in 30 hours, maybe I can go fishing.
Yeah. Well, Oren, thank you so much for taking the time today. I'm excited about the future. I can tell from your energy that you are too, and I really appreciate you taking the time on the Shift podcast today.
Well, as I really appreciate the invitation and all the good questions, both personal and technical, and thank you. Hope to talk soon.
All right. Thank you. That's a wrap. Thanks for tuning in. Such a pleasure to have Oren as our guest on today's episode. Oren's knowledge and experience incubating AI companies and his stories about meeting with President Biden and shaping policy provide a very unique set of insights. If you want to learn more about Oren, you can find him on LinkedIn and Twitter. If you are interested in how he thinks about venture investing and AI policy, definitely connect with him and keep up with his posts and activities online. I continue to be amazed by the guests we've had on the show, and I'm excited about the ones joining us in the near future. I truly appreciate you spending your time with us. Thank you for listening to the episode. Don't forget to subscribe to the Shift AI podcast for more exciting interviews and to the Simply AI Weekly newsletter for updates on how AI can help you scale your business. The Shift AI podcast is produced and sponsored by Simply Augmented, and our theme music was created by Dave Angel.